From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Lips by Henry S. Whitehead. The Soul Taverner, Blackbirder, Luke Martin, Master, up from Cartagena, came to her anchor in the harbor of St. Thomas, capital and chief town of the Danish West Indies. A Martinique barkentine, berthed to leeward of her, sent a fully manned boat ashore after the harbor master with a request for permission to change anchorage. Luke Martin's shore boat was only a few lengths behind the Frenchman's. Martin shouted after the officer whom it landed. "Tell O'Leek I'll change places with you and welcome. What you carrying, brandy? I'll take 6 cases off ya." The barkentine's mate, a French island mulatto, nodded over his shoulder and noted down the order in a leather pocketbook without slackening his pace. It was no joyful experience to lie in a semi-enclosed harbor directly to leeward of a slaver, and haste was indicated despite orders for brandy. "Very well, captain," said the mate stiffly. Martin landed as the Martinique mate rounded a corner to the left and disappeared from view in the direction of the harbor master's. Martin scowled after him, muttering to himself, "Airs. Talking English, language of the islands, thinking in French, you and your heirs, and your grandfather come out of a blackbird ship like's not, you and your heirs." Reaching the corner, the mate had turned. Martin glanced after him momentarily, then turned to the right, mounting a slight rise. His business ashore took him to the fort. He intended to land his cargo, or a portion of it, that night. The colony was short of field hands. With the help of troops from Martinique, French troops and Spaniards from its nearer neighbors, Puerto Rico, it had just put down a bloody uprising on its subsidiary island of St. Jan. Many of the slaves had been killed in the joint armed reprisal of the year 1833. Luke Martin got his permission to land his cargo, therefore without difficulty, and being a Yankee bucko who let no grass grow under his feet, 4 bells in the afternoon watch saw the hatches off and the decks of the Sol Taverner swarming with manacled blacks for the ceremony of washing down. Huddled together, blinking in the glaring sun of a July afternoon, under parallel 18 north latitude, the mass of swart humanity were soaked with handfuls of waste out of soft soap buckets, scrubbed with brushes on the ends of short handles, and rinsed off with other buckets. Boatloads of Negroes surrounded the ship to see the washing down, and these were kept at a distance by a swearing third mate, told off for the purpose. By 7 bells the washing down was completed, and before sundown a row of lighters, each guarded by a pair of Danish gendarmes with muskets and fixed bayonets, had ranged alongside for the taking off of the 117 blacks who were to be landed, most of whom would be sent to replenish the laborers on the plantation of St. Jan, off the other side of the island of St. Thomas. The disembarking process began just after dark, to the light of lanterns. Great care was exercised by all concerned lest any escape by plunging overboard. A tally clerk from shore checked off the blacks as they went over the side into the lighters, and these, as they became filled, were rowed to the landing stage by other slaves, bending over 6 great sweeps in each of the stubbed, heavy wooden boats. Among the huddled black bodies of the very last batch stood a woman, very tall and thin, with a newborn child, black as a coal, at her breasts. The woman stood a little aloof from the others, farther from the low rail of the Salt Taverner's forward deck, crooning to her infant. Behind her approached Luke Martin, impatient of his unloading, and cut at her thin ankles with his rhinoceros leather whip. The woman did not wince. Instead, she turned her head and muttered a few syllables in a low tone in the Igbo dialect. Martin shoved her into the mass of blacks, cursing roundly as he cut a second time at the spindling shins. The woman turned very quietly and softly as he was passing behind her, let her head fall softly on Martin's shoulder and whispered into his ear. The motion was so delicate as to simulate a caress, but Martin's curse died in his throat. He howled in pain as the woman raised her head, and his whip clattered on the deck boarding, while the hand which had held it went to the shoulder. The woman, deftly holding her infant, had moved in among the huddling blacks, a dozen or more of whom intervened between her and Martin, who hopped on one foot and cursed a vicious continuous stream of foul epithets, then still cursing made his way in haste to his cabin after an antiseptic, any idea of revenge swallowed up in his superstitious dread of what might happen to him if he did not forthwith dress the ghastly wound just under his left ear, where the black woman had caused her firm, white and shining teeth to meet in the great muscle of his neck between shoulder and jaw. When he emerged 10 minutes later, the wound now soaked in permanent of potash and roughly clotted with a clean cloth. The last lighter, under the impetus of its 6 sweeps, was halfway ashore, and the clerk of the government from the fort was awaiting him with a bag of coin and a pair of gendarmes to guard it. He accompanied the government clerk below, where the gendarmes at the cabin door they figured and added and counted money for the next hour, a bottle of sound rum, and a pair of glasses between them. At 2 bells, under a shining moon, the Salt Taverner, taking advantage of the evening trade wind, was running for the harbor's mouth to stand away for Norfolk, Virginia, whence empty she would run up the coast for her home port of Boston, Massachusetts. It was midnight. What with the care of his ship coming out of even the plain and safe harbor of St. Thomas, before Martin the skipper, Culebra Lighthouse off the port quarter, turned in. The wound in the top of his shoulder ached dully, and he sent for Matthew Pound, his first mate, to wash it out with more permanganate and dress it suitably. It was in an awkward place. Curse the black slut, for him to manage it for himself. Pound went white and muttered under his breath at the ugly sight of it when Martin had removed his shirt, painfully, and eased off the cloth he had roughly laid over it, a cloth now stiff and clotted with the exuding blood drying on its inner surface from the savage wound. Thereafter, not liking the look on his mate's face, nor that whitening which the sight of the place in his neck had brought about, Martin dispensed with assistance and dressed the wound himself. He slept little that first night, but this was partly for thinking of the bargain he had driven with those short-handed Danes. They had been hard up for black meat to sweat on those hillside cane fields over on St. Jan. He could have disposed easily of his entire cargo, but that, unfortunately, was out of the question. He had, what with an exceptionally slow and hot voyage across the Caribbean from Cartagena, barely enough of his said cargo left to fulfill his engagement to deliver a certain number of head in Norfolk. But he would have been glad enough to rid his hold of them all, curse them, and set his course straight for Boston. He was expecting to be married the day after his arrival. He was eager to get home, and even now the Salt Taverner was carrying as much sail as she could stand up under, heeling now to the unfailing trade wind of this latitude. The wound ached and pained, nonetheless, and he found it well nigh impossible to settle himself in a comparatively comfortable position on its account. He tossed and cursed far into the warm night. Towards morning, he fell into a fitful doze. The entire side of his neck and shoulder was one huge, searing ache when he awakened and pushed himself carefully upright with both hands. He could not bend his head nor, at first, move it from side to side. Dressing was a very painful process, but he managed it. He wanted to see what the bite looked like, but as he never shaved during a voyage, there was no glass in his cabin. He bathed the sore place gingerly with bay rum, which hurt abominably and caused him to curse afresh. Dressed at last, he made his way up on deck, past the steward who was laying breakfast in his cabin. The steward, he thought, glanced at him curiously, but he could not be sure. No wonder. He had to walk sidewise, with the pain of his neck like a crab. He ordered more sail, stunsails, and these set and sheeted home. He returned to the cabin for breakfast. Mid-afternoon saw him, despite the vessel's more than satisfactory speed and the progress of a long lead towards Boston and Lydia Farnham, in such a devilish temper that everyone on board the ship kept as far as possible out of his way. He took no night watches, these being divided among the three mates, and after his solitary supper, punctuated with numerous curses at a more than usually awkward steward, he went into a stateroom, removed his shirt and singlet, and thoroughly rubbed the entire aching area with coconut oil. The pain now ran down his left arm to the elbow and penetrated to all the cords of his neck, the muscles of which throbbed and burned atrociously. The embrocation gave him a certain amount of relief. He remembered that the woman had muttered something. It was not Igbo, that jargon of lingua franca which served as a medium for the few remarks necessary between slavers and their human cattle. It was some outlandish coastal or tribal dialect. He had not caught it, sensed its meaning, though there had resided in those few syllables some germ of deadly meaning. He remembered vaguely the cadence of the syllables, even though their meaning had been unknown to him. Swearing, aching, depressed, he turned in, and this time, almost immediately, he fell asleep. And in his sleep, those syllables were repeated to him, into his left ear, endlessly, over and over again. And in his sleep, he knew their meaning. And when he awoke, a swaying beam of pouring moonlight coming through his porthole at 4 bells after midnight, the cold sweat had made his pillow clammy wet and stood dankly in the hollows of his eyes and soaked his tangled beard. Burning from head to foot, he rose and lit the candle in his binnacle light and cursed himself again for a fool for not acquiring a mirror through the day. Young Summer, the third mate, shaved. One or two of the Foscoll's hands, too. There would be mirrors on board. He must obtain one tomorrow. What was it the woman had said? Those syllables? He shuddered. He could not remember. Why should he remember? Gibberish? It was nothing. Merely the act of a bestial black. They were all alike. He should have taken the living hide off the wench. To bite him. Well, painful as it was, it should be well healed before he got back to Boston and Lydia. Laboriously, for he was very stiff and sore all along the left side, he climbed back into his bed after blowing out the binnacle light. That candle wick, it was very foul. He should have wet his thumb and finger and pinched it out. It was still smoking. Then the syllables again, endlessly, over and over. And now that he slept, and somehow knew that he slept, and could not carry their meaning into the next waking state, he knew what they meant. Asleep, drowned in sleep, he tossed from side to side of his berth bed, and the cold sweat ran in oily trickles down into his thick beard. He awakened in the early light of morning in a state of horrified half-realization. He could not get up, it seemed. The ache now ran through all his body, which felt as though it had been beaten until flayed. One of the brandy bottles from the Martinique barkentine, opened the night of departure from St. Thomas, was within reach. He got it, painfully drew the cork with his teeth, holding the bottle in his right hand, and took a long, gasping drink of the neat spirit. He could feel it through him like liquid golden fire. Oh, that was better. He raised the bottle again, set it back where it had been half empty. He made a great effort to roll out of the berth, failed, sank back, well-nigh helpless, his head humming and singing like a hive of angry bees. He lay there, semi-stupefied now, vague and dreadful things working within his head, his mind, his body, things brewing, seething, there inside him as though something had entered into him and was growing there, where the focus of pain throbbed in the great muscles of his neck on the left side. There, an hour later, a timid steward found him after repeated and unanswered knocks on the stateroom door. The steward had at last ventured to open the door, a mere peeping slit, and then softly closing it behind him, and white-faced hastened to find Pound, the first mate. Pound, after consultation with the second mate, Sumner, accompanied the steward to the stateroom door, opening off the captain's cabin. Even there, hard buckle that he was, he hesitated. No one aboard the Saul Taverner approached Captain Luke Martin with a sense of ease or anything like self-assurance. Pound repeated the steward's door opening, peeped within, and thereafter entered the cabin, shutting the door. Martin lay on his right side, the bedclothes pushed down to near his waist. He slept in a singlet, and the left side of his neck was uppermost. Pound looked long at the wound, his face like chalk, his hands and lips trembling. Then he softly departed, shutting the door behind him a second time, and went thoughtfully up on deck again. He sought out young Sumner, and the two spoke together for several minutes. Then Sumner went below to his cabin, and emerging on the deck, looked furtively all around him. Observing the coast clear, he drew from beneath his drill jacket something twice the size of his hand, and again glancing about to make sure he was not observed, dropped the article overboard. It flashed in the bright morning sun as it turned about in the air before the waters received it forever. It was his small cabin shaving mirror. At 4 bells in the forenoon, Pound again descended to the captain's cabin. This time Martin's voice, a weak voice, answered his discreet knock, and at its invitation he entered the stateroom. Martin now lay on his back, his left side away from the door. "How are you feeling, sir?" asked Pound. "Better," murmured Martin. "This damn thing." He indicated the left side of his neck with a motion of his right thumb. "I got some sleep this morning. Just woke up just now. It's better. The worst of it over, I reckon." A pause fell between the men. There seemed nothing more to say. Finally, after several twitches and fidgeting, Pound mentioned several details about the ship, the surest way to enlist Martin's interest at any time. Martin replied, and Pound took his departure. Martin had spoken the truth when he alleged he was better. He had awakened with a sense that the worst was over. The wound ached abominably still, but the unpleasantness was distinctly lessened. He got up, rather languidly, slowly pulled on his deck clothes, called for coffee through the stateroom door. Yet when he emerged on his deck 10 minutes later, his face was drawn and haggard, and there was a look in his eyes that kept the men silent. He looked over the ship professionally, the regular 6 bells morning inspection, but he was preoccupied, and his usual intense interest in anything concerned with his ship was this day merely perfunctionary. For nearly constantly now that the savage pain was somewhat allayed and tending to grow less, as the deck exercise cleared his mind and body of their poisons, those last syllables, the muttered syllables in his left ear, when the black woman's head had lain for an instant on his shoulder, those syllables, which were not an Igbo, kept repeating themselves to him. It was as though they were constantly reiterated in his physical ear, rather than merely mentally. Vague syllables with one word, Likundu, standing out and pounding itself deeper and deeper into his consciousness. "Hearing things," he muttered to himself as he descended to his cabin on the conclusion of the routine morning inspection a half hour before noon. He did not go up on deck again for the noon observations. He remained sitting very quietly there in his cabin, listening to what was being whispered over and over again in his left ear, the ear above the wound in his neck muscle. It was highly unusual for this full-blooded bucko skipper to be quiet, as his cabin steward roundly noted. The explanation was, however, very far from the steward's mind. He imagined that the wound had had a devastating effect upon the captain's nerves, and so far his intuition was a right one. But beyond that, the steward's crude psychology did not penetrate. He would have been skeptical, amused, scornful, had anyone suggested to him that the true reason for this unaccustomed silence and quietude on the part of his employer, Captain Luke Martin, for the first time in his heady and truculent career, was frightened. He ate little for his midday dinner and immediately afterward retired to his stateroom. He came out again almost at once, however, and mounted the cabin ladder to the after deck. The sole taverner, carrying a heavy load of canvas, was spanking along at a good 12 knots. Martin looked aloft, like a sound sailor man, when he emerged on deck, but his preoccupied gaze came down and seemed to young Sumner, who touched his hat to him to look inward. Martin was addressing him. "I want the lend of your looking-glass," said he in a quiet tone. Young Sumner started, felt the blood leave his face. This was what Pound had warned him about, why he had thrown his glass over the side. "Sorry, sir. It ain't along with me this voyage, sir. I had it till we lay in St. Thomas, but now it's gone. I couldn't shave this morning, sir." The young mate made an evidential gesture, rubbing a sunburned hand across his day's growth of beard on a weak but not unhandsome face. He expected a bull-like roar of annoyance from the captain. Instead, Martin merely nodded absently and walked forward. Sumner watched him interestedly till he reached the hatch leading to the crew's quarters below decks forward. Then, "Cripes! He'll get one from Dave Sloan!" And young Sumner ran to find Pound and tell him that the captain would probably have a looking-glass within a minute. He was very curious to know the whys and wherefores of his senior mate's unusual request about his own looking-glass. He had obeyed, but he wanted to know, for here indeed was something very strange. Pound had merely told him the captain mustn't see that wound in his neck, which was high enough up so that without a glass he could not manage to look at it. "What's it like, Mr. Pound?" he ventured to inquire. "It's what you'd name kind of livid-like," returned Pound slowly. "It's kind of purplish. Looks like lips." Back in his stateroom, Martin, after closing the door leading to the cabin, started to take off his shirt. He was halfway through this operation when he was summoned on deck. He hastily readjusted the shirt, almost shamefacedly as though discovered in some shameful act, and mounted the ladder. Pound engaged him for 20 minutes. Ship matters. He gave his decision in the same half-hearted voice which was so new to those about him, and descended again. The bit of mirror glass which he had borrowed from Sloan in the forecastle was gone from his waistband. He looked painfully all over the cabin for it, but it was not there. Ordinarily, such a thing happening would have elicited a very tempest of raging curses. Now he sat down almost helplessly and stared about the stateroom with unseeing eyes, but not with unheeding ears. The voice was speaking English now, no longer gibberish, syllables grouped about the one clear word, Lekundu. The voice in his left ear was compelling, tense, repetitive. "Over the side," it was repeating to him, and again and yet again, "over the side." He sat there a long time. Then at last, perhaps an hour later, his face, which there was no one by to see, now pinched, drawn and gray in the bold, challenging afternoon light, in the white-painted stateroom, he rose slowly and with almost furtive motions, began to pull off his shirt. He got it off, laid it on his berth, drew off the light singlet which he wore underneath it, and slowly, tentatively, with his right hand, reached for the wound in his neck. As his hand approached it, he felt cold and weak. At last his hand, fingers groping, touched the sore and tender area of the wound. Felt about, found the wound itself. It was Pound who found him 2 hours later, huddled in a heap on the cramped floor of the stateroom, naked to the waist, unconscious. It was Pound, hard old Pound, who laboriously propped the captain's great bulk, for he was a heavy-set man, standing 6 feet in height, into his chair, pulled the singlet and then the discarded shirt over his head, and then poured brandy between his bluish lips. It required half an hour of the mate's rough restoratives, brandy, chafing of the hands, slapping the limp, huge wrists, before Captain Luke Martin's eyelids fluttered, and the big man gradually came awake. But Pound found the monosyllabic answers to his few brief questions cryptic and inappropriate. It was as though Martin were answering someone else, some other voice. "I will," he said wearily, and again, "Yes, I will." It was then, looking him up and down in considerable puzzlement, that the mate saw the blood on the fingers of his right hand, picked up the great, heavy hand now lying limply on the arm of the stateroom chair. The three middle fingers had been bleeding for some time. The blood from them was now dry and clotted. Pound, picking up the hand, examining it in the light of the lowering afternoon sun, saw that these fingers had been savagely cut, or it looked like sawed. It was as though the saw teeth that had ground and torn them had grated along their bones. It was a ghastly wound. Pound, trembling from head to foot, fumbling about the medicine case, mixed a bowl of permanganate solution, soaked the unresisting hand, bound it up. He spoke to Martin several times, but Martin's eyes were looking at something far away, his ears deaf to his mate's words. Now and again he nodded his head, and once more, before old Pound left them, sitting there limply, he muttered, "Yes, yes, I will, I will." Pound visited him again just before four bells, in the early evening supper time. He was still seated, looking somehow shrunken, apathetic. "Supper, Captain?" inquired Pound tentatively. Martin did not raise his eyes. His lips moved, however, and Pound bent to catch what was being said. "Yes, yes, yes," said Martin. "I will, I will. Yes, I will." "It's late in the cabin, sir," ventured Pound, but he got no reply, and he slipped out, closing the door behind him. "The captain's sick, McGuire," said Pound to the little steward. "You might as well take down the table and all that, and then go forward as soon as you're finished."
Aye, sir," replied the wandering steward, proceeded to unset the cabin table according to these orders. Pound saw him through with these duties, followed him out on deck, saw that he went forward as directed. Then he returned softly. He paused outside the stateroom door, listened. There was someone talking in there, someone besides the skipper, a thick voice, like one of the Negroes, but very faint, thick, guttural, but light, a voice like a young boy's or a woman's. Pound, stupefied, listened, his ear now directly against the door. He could not catch through the thickness what was being said, but it was in form, by the repeated sound, the captain's voice, alternating with a light guttural voice, clearly a conversation, like question and answer, question and answer. The ship had no boy. Of women there was a couple of dozen, but all of them were battened below, under hatches, black women down in the stinking manhole. Besides the captain, there could not be a woman in there with him. No woman, no one at all, could have got in. The stateroom had been occupied only by the captain when he had left it 15 minutes before. He had not been out of sight of the closed door all that time. Yet, he listened the more intently, his mind now wholly intrigued by the strange riddle. He caught the cadence of Martin's words, now the same cadence. He knew instinctively as that of the broken sentence he had been repeating to him in his half-day state while he was binding up those gashed fingers. Those fingers! He shuddered. The Salt Taverner was a hell ship. None was better aware of that than he, who had largely contributed through many voyages in her to that sinister reputation she bore. But this was something like real hell. "Yes, yes, I will, I will, I will." That was a swing, the total cadence of what Martin was saying, at more or less regular intervals in there. Then the guttural light voice, the two going on alternately, one after the other, no pauses in that outlandish conversation. Abruptly the conversation ceased. It was as though a soundproof door had been pulled down over it. Pound straightened himself up, waited a minute, then knocked on the door. The door was abruptly thrown open from inside, and Captain Luke Martin, his eyes glassy, unseeing, stepped out, Pound giving way before him. The captain paused in the middle of his cabin, looking about him, his eyes still bearing that unseeing look. Then he made his way straight toward the companion ladder. He was going up on deck, it seemed. His clothes hung on him now, his shirt awry, his trousers crumpled, and seemed, where he had lain on the floor, sat huddled up in the small chair where Pound had placed him. Pound followed him up the ladder. Once on deck, he made his way straight to the port rail, and stood, looking, still as though unseeingly, out over the billowing waves. It was dark now. The subtropic dusk had lately fallen. The ship was quiet save for the noises of her sharp bows as they cut through the middle North Atlantic swell on her 12-knot way to Virginia. Suddenly old Pound sprang forward, grappled with Martin. The captain had started to climb the rail. Suicide, that was it. Then, those voices! The thwarting of what seemed to be his purpose aroused Martin at last. Behind him lay a middle-aged man's lifetime of command, of following his own will in all things. He was not accustomed to being thwarted, to any resistance, which aboard his own ship always went down, died stillborn before his bull-like bellow, his truculent fists. He grappled in turn with his mate, and a long, desperate, and withal a silent struggle began there on the deck, lighted only by the light from the captain's cabin below, the light of the great binnacle lamp of whale oil, through the skylights set above decks for daytime illumination below. In the course of that silent, deadly struggle, Pound, seeking to drag the captain back from the vicinity of the rail, the captain laying about him with vicious blows, the man became rapidly disheveled. Martin had been coatless, and a great swath of his white shirt came away in the clutching grip of Pound, baring his neck and left shoulder. Pound slackened, let go, shrank and reeled away, covering his eyes lest they be blasted from their sockets by the horror which he had seen. For there, where the short had been torn away and exposed the side of Martin's neck, stood a pair of blackish purple, perfectly formed, blubbery lips, and as he gazed, appalled, horrified, the lips had opened in a wide yawn, exposing great, shining teeth, from between which, before he could bury his face in his hand, away from his horror, a long pink tongue had protruded and licked the lips. And when old Pound, shaking now to his very marrow, cold with the horror of this dreadful portent, there on the deck warm with the pulsing breath of the trade wind, had recovered himself sufficiently to look again towards the place where the master of the Saul Taverner had struggled with him there against the railing, that place stood empty, and no trace of Luke Martin so much as ruffled the phosphorescent surface of the Saul Taverner's creaming wake.